Hi, this is Dark Journalist. In my investigations into political assassinations, I found something absolutely incredible. That the covert forces behind the assassinations, right down to the patsies that they selected, were directly associated with advanced technology and the UFO file. Now, I've referred to this as X-technology because of an obscure naming mechanism called X-steganography that is utilized when it is moved through various government agencies. I found evidence for a group that we will call X-Protect that employs lethal means to hide the secret X-technology in the UFO file. Now, X-Protect exists in the shadowy corridor where the intelligence community meets with secret aerospace defense contractors. I'm going to present breakthrough evidence that will show clearly that the assassinations of JFK, RFK, and MLK, which changed the ruling structure of America and the world, were directly connected to X-Protect. The impact on our lives economically, geopolitically, technologically, psychologically, and even spiritually from these events cannot be overstated. This information has been hiding in plain sight for decades. The startling revelations around their activities and the direct correlation between the UFO file assassins and the X technology will be revealed here for the first time in great detail and will change our understanding of history forever. The facts and testimony presented will be unmistakable. Let's get started. By 1947, billionaire Howard Hughes had carved out a unique space for his company, Hughes Aircraft, setting records and snapping up the lion's share of government military contracts. Born in 1904, Hughes had come a long way since both of his parents had died, leaving the 19-year-old the sole heir to a massive fortune built by his father at Hughes Tool Company in Texas, which patented an innovative rotary drill bit that revolutionized oil drilling during the Texas oil boom. Hughes would go on to become a fantastically successful movie producer, running RKO Studios and even directing the controversial favorite The Outlaw, featuring Jane Russell. But his real love was aviation, and he had become legendary with his spectacular flying successes, like his flight around the world in 3 days, and also some bizarre entries, including the reconnaissance aircraft, the XF-11, which Hughes crashed flying low into Beverly Hills, but survived. There were also what appeared to be spectacular failures, like the Hughes H-4 Hercules, the so-called Spruce Goose, a massive flying boat, unlike anything seen before it. There were rumors that Hughes was keeping a major secret so competitors couldn't discover what he was working on. An innovation so great, it would change aviation forever. The spiraling rumors and Hughes' enemies got so out of hand that Hughes had to testify before a Senate committee investigating the lack of transparency around his secretive plans and designs.
When Senator Brewster realized that he was fighting a battle against public opinion, a losing battle, he folded up and took a runout powder.
In 1948, Hughes created the Aerospace Group with a vision of conquering space travel. According to reports, he was spurred on in part by seeing some unusual debris when he was called into Roswell in mid-1947 to observe the strange material. Roswell would become the first known UFO crash when residents reported seeing unusual lights in the sky, and a rancher named Mac Brazel told authorities about a large-scale debris field scattered on his ranch from a crash craft of some kind. Intelligence officer Major Jesse Marcel from the 509th Atomic Bomb Group was the first to see the wreckage. He described a mysterious metal that wouldn't bend or burn, along with strange markings that resembled Egyptian hieroglyphics.
It was not anything from this earth that I'm quite sure of, because I was, being an intelligence officer, I was familiar with just about all materials used in aircraft and in our air travel. This was nothing like that. It could not have been.
The Army covered up the crash, explaining it away as a weather balloon, but a select group of aviation specialists were called in to view the UFO crash remains. According to several accounts from retired military personnel, Hughes was asked for his expertise, but reportedly attempted to take over the entire operation of examining the UFO wreckage. Hughes was asked to leave the project. The legendary aviator had imparted to a flying friend that he had observed UFOs before for many years. Bruce Morgan, the son of Hollywood film star Yvonne DiCarlo, who dated Hughes in the period between 1946 and 1948, recalls how her cousin, Kenneth Ross McKenzie, a pilot in the Canadian Air Force who flew with Hughes, described his fascination with these unknown craft.
Her cousin, Ken Ross McKenzie, who was in the Canadian RCAF. Ken Ross McKenzie took flights with Howard Hughes, and during that time, when they were up at altitude flying around, Howard Hughes had some kind of kinship with Ken, because when they were alone in that plane, the conversations got very personal about why Hughes was interested in these strange crafts. He said, "I'm a designer, and I want to know." There was very little looking out of the window at night, as most pilots will tell you, but what did come through sometimes, like big flashing beacons and the speed of them, as Hughes related, he said, "I'm an aircraft designer. I don't know where this stuff is from, but I sometimes get envious as we're working on things. Whoever the hell is up here using this is way ahead of me." And he wanted to know about design. And he figured, well, this has got to be the cutting edge if these things are going that fast. And Hughes talked about this stuff and then wanted to show Yvonne something.
Morgan relates how Hughes wanted to show Yvonne DiCarlo something that had crashed in an area outside of Las Vegas. The area was called Rose Wells. Morgan describes what happened here.
And he's taking Yvonne up in their plane, in his plane, personally. And they go up to what I think was Reno, to a place called the Mapes. Now, the time standard we're talking about here is somewhere between 1946, and it couldn't be later than 49, because at that point she was involved with the Prince of Iran, Abdureza Pahlavi. So it had to be before 49, and sometimes her and Hughes would be in several places in Hollywood, and he was always the odd guy out, but always invited because he was interesting. On this occasion, they went up to a place and spent three solid days together. So after 3 days of all things must come to an end, and he says, "I want to show you something interesting on the way back." And he started to make calls, because you have to shift over to get to the 95 to get to the area which was designated in the phone call as Rose Wells, which is on very old maps, but nowhere now. What he conveyed to her was that this had been a crash and there was something interesting. And she said, "Oh, sure." And as she started packing, she started to get feelings. And what she told me as to why she even remembered this was that she said, "I suddenly realized if I saw what he was going to show me, I would never get it out of my mind." And she said, "Let's go back to Hollywood." Now, why this story got told years later is the following. She's sitting long past normal retirement, maybe a few more years to live, and she's watching a documentary on Bob Lazar describing his adventure on looking at the inside of a UFO. Specifically, I think it was called the Sport Model. And he stuck his head in and he described his feelings, but more than anything else, what Yvonne keyed in with was when he said, "I didn't feel like I belonged there." And she suddenly realized, she said, "I believe he's telling the truth." And it made her remember and then tell me about this event with Hughes. Because of what Lazar said, she said, "I remember this. And I remember thinking, I don't want to see this." She could already feel something about this. And maybe, who knows, maybe she could even visualize it in her mind, because the whole family on the DiCarlo side was psychic. And she said, "If I see this, I'll never get it out of my mind."
Years later, DiCarlo would reflect on her relationship with the mysterious aviator.
"Did you have a fling with Howard Hughes?"
"That was more than a fling. It was a romance for about 3 years."
"Yeah. Oh, he was wonderful then."
"Yeah. Yeah.
He taught me how to fly. He wouldn't marry me, so I gave him up."
The strange destination that Hughes wanted to bring DiCarlo to, called Rose Wells, was eventually removed from official maps of the area. But Morgan found these examples showing exactly where it was.
"The one that I showed you was the oldest. That goes back to like 1911, you know, really old. Then it disappears, and what you get around it is the area of Pahrump, where Ard Bell was, so that people know, well, where is this? You're north of Indian Springs, you're south of Mercury, and you're on the 95, and you're looking off to your left if you're going north, which means it's on the west side of the highway, and it's not that far off, but it has disappeared as a stated place on the map."
UFO crash sites disappearing off maps. A strong desire to replicate the UFO X technology that he had witnessed during his own flights. Hughes had gone deep into the UFO mystery, And soon other covert forces would be looking to use that fact to their advantage. Robert Mayhew was a CIA operative involved in black ops and assassinations since the 1940s. He joined the Hughes organization in 1954 and became a chief aide, controlling Hughes' Nevada operations. From the start, he cast a dark shadow with his web of CIA connections over all of Hughes' activities. In 1975, he confessed to the Church Committee investigating CIA atrocities that in 1960, he had met with mobster Johnny Roselli on behalf of CIA Director Alan Dulles to assassinate Cuban leader Fidel Castro. Dulles was fired by JFK in 1961 for attempts to draw the U.S. into a war with Cuba. Mayhew's role in the assassination of Senator Robert Kennedy in 1968 can now be revealed. John Meyer, the number two man in the Hughes organization, has put on record that Mayhew carried out the assassination.
I'm John Meyer, former advisor to the recluse billionaire Howard Hughes. Among my acquaintances at that time were members of the Nixon family, Vice President Hubert Humphrey, head of the FBI J. Edgar Hoover, Paul Schrade, who was shot at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, along with Robert Kennedy, Harry Evans, who was 6 feet away from Kennedy when Kennedy was shot, and numerous others that are pertinent to this tragic event. The Hughes organization was involved in the assassination of Robert Kennedy in 1968.
Meyer witnessed some of the most important operations of the Hughes organization in the 1960s. Seeing them become involved in Robert Kennedy's assassination was a devastating shock to him. Coming into the 1968 presidential election, President Lyndon Johnson had withdrawn from the race when Senator Robert Kennedy had entered. Kennedy, who had served as Attorney General in his brother John F. Kennedy's administration and had become a senator after President Kennedy's assassination, was the odds-on favorite to win against Republican challenger Richard Nixon. Nixon, who had lost his previous bid for the presidency in 1960 to John F. Kennedy, was a longtime Hughes crony. It was well known that Hughes had even given Nixon's brother, Don Nixon, a huge loan to start a chain of fast food restaurants, and that in return, Nixon had used his powers as vice president to get Hughes Aerospace to be run through Hughes Medical Institute as a charity and therefore not subject to taxation, saving Hughes untold millions of dollars and clearing the way for massive black project space development. To this day, the IRS has kept all the records of its dealings with Hughes on this matter completely secret. John Meyer had met with Robert Kennedy shortly before his death, and Kennedy had told him he knew about what had happened regarding the Hughes Medical Institute and was going to expose it. The enmity between RFK and Hughes was all Mayhew needed to put his assassination plan into action. Meyer kept a diary from his Hughes days that he released in a book called Age of Secrets. The book was heavily censored with almost no coverage and was essentially buried. The crucial breakthroughs in the diary reveal the hand of the Hughes organization through Robert Mayhew in the assassination of Senator Robert Kennedy in Los Angeles at the Ambassador Hotel on June 5th, 1968.
My thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there.
Senator Robert Kennedy died on June 6, 1968 at 4:44 a.m. Had he not been assassinated, most political experts agree he would have easily beaten Richard Nixon and won the presidential election. Mayhew, Hughes, and the CIA couldn't afford to have a Kennedy back in the White House. The X-technology they had been secretly cultivating with Hughes Aerospace couldn't be revealed. X-Protect would need to risk exposure to keep the UFO file in their hands. The outline of a complex and targeted plot to prevent Senator Robert Kennedy from becoming president is clearly laid out in John Meyer's diary. He was seeing through the players of a dangerous game. An excerpt reads, October 25th, 1969. My friends and I were taken to the president's yacht all day. We also visited the president's beach house. On the yacht, I sat stunned as Don Nixon, after many drinks, started talking about the RFK assassination, his brother being in Texas when JFK was assassinated, and Bob Mayhew telling Don about Bob's conversation with Don in Las Vegas. Mayhew took credit for the RFK murder. The ones that sat around the table with their mouths open were shocked. There was more. Thane Eugene Caesar was a security guard that had been hired only 3 days previously by the Ambassador Hotel. He was directly behind Senator Kennedy when he was shot that night. In the confusion of Sirhan shooting his gun some 5 feet in front of Kennedy, witnesses also saw Caesar draw and fire his gun. Caesar would change his story several times about what happened that night, claiming he never fired a shot. The police never tested his gun. Well-known L.A. County coroner Thomas Noguchi did an autopsy on Senator Kennedy. It showed that he had been shot at point-blank range in the back of the head, about 1 inch from his right ear.
In other words, if I pressed my fingers in the back, it's about 3 inches away from the senator's ear.
Since Sirhan was identified by witnesses as being 5 feet in front of Kennedy, Noguchi's findings indicated that Sirhan was not the assassin of Robert Kennedy. Whoever it was had to be directly behind him. The person behind Kennedy was Thane Eugene Caesar. Meyer's diary excerpt. June 13th, 1968. Listening to the radio where they were discussing the RFK assassination and who was shot, etc., they mentioned Thane Caesar, who was a security guard at the hotel working for ACE Guard Security and was also employed by Lockheed Aircraft. I remember Thane from his trips to Vegas, where he was meeting with numerous gaming people and was introduced to me by Jack Hooper, an associate of Bob Mayhew. June 14th, 1968. Bob Mayhew called and told me to come over to his house at 8:30 p.m. that evening, and I did. He was furious and wanted to know why I was checking up on Thane. I was stunned at his anger, and he said to me that if I kept discussing this matter, he would see that I was no longer around the Hughes operation. He then told me that he was responsible for all security matters in Nevada, and he would personally handle the Paul Schrade convalescence at the ranch. June 15th, 1968, 8 a.m., received a call from Jack Hooper, who told me that he was speaking with Bob Mayhew, and I was never to mention his name or Bel Air Patrol. He told me Mayhew wanted to speak to me after we spoke, and I called Mayhew 15 minutes later. Bob wanted to impress upon me that he was in charge of the Nevada operations, and everything I did in Nevada involving Hughes, he was to be informed about. It's clear from these excerpts from Hughes' aide, John Meyer, that from the outset, Bob Mayhew was worried that Meyer had figured out his role in the assassination of Robert Kennedy. His inquiries about Thane Eugene Caesar led Mayhew to issue the not-so-subtle threats and final ultimatum for Meyer to cease looking into this before it was too late. Mayhew and the CIA forces behind him saw Meyer as a dangerous wild card as they moved to consolidate the Hughes organization and conceal their crime. The actions of X-Protect to preserve the wall of secrecy around covert aerospace programs would change society forever. Since the John Frankenheimer film The Manchurian Candidate came out in the early 1960s, the clandestine idea of a mind-controlled assassin had been in the public mind, although it wouldn't be clear for another decade that the program was in fact entirely real, and something the CIA, on record, had destroyed all of its files on concerning its existence. With his deep CIA history and black ops background, Mayhew had access to the best CIA mind-control programmers. The jaw-dropping detail that Mayhew operative Johnny Roselli was co-owner of the Santa Anita racetrack that employed Sirhan suggests that Mayhew had Roselli find the patsy to be programmed for the RFK assassination. Sirhan, being introverted and highly suggestible, made an ideal candidate. Sirhan would disappear for months, with no contact to family and friends, just before his strange appearance at the Ambassador Hotel. Years later, CIA MKUltra hypnoprogrammer William Bryan would brag to friends that he had programmed Sirhan to be at the Ambassador and shoot that night. Sirhan's own notebooks, found after the assassination, mention the name of Albert DeSalvo, the infamous Boston Strangler, who had been coerced into a confession under hypnosis by the very same William Bryan.
You have to have the person locked up physically to have control over them. You have to use a certain amount of physical torture involved. And there is also the use of long-term hypnotic suggestion, probably drugs, whatever, and so on. Yeah. Under these situations where you have all this going for you, like the prison camp and so on, yes, you can brainwash a person to do just about anything. What I'm speaking about are the innumerable instances that we ran into when I was running the country's brainwashing and anti-brainwashing programs.
Sirhan claimed to have no memory after the incident and thought he was at a shooting range, with Mayhew's strongman Thane Eugene Caesar pulling off the murder and Sirhan to take the fall for the crime. The stage was set for Nixon to become president and for Hughes to have the most powerful man in the world support his efforts to make Hughes Aerospace the future of space travel and defense. In a chilling final excerpt from Meyer's diary, he tells of Mayhew meeting Nixon's brother, Don, the morning that it was announced that Senator Robert Kennedy had died. June 6, 1968, 5 a.m., Bob Mayhew called to ask about the Don-Nixon meeting and suggested 8:30 for breakfast at the Desert Inn Country Club. I went to the club. Mayhew was all smiles. And Don Nixon walks in all smiles. What followed next had to be seen to be believed. They embraced each other and Don Nixon said, "Well, that prick is dead." And Mayhew said, "Well, it looks like your brother is in now." At the time, I did not even know what they were talking about. Mayhew joked that they should now be calling Don Nixon Mr. Vice President. In a final twist, Caesar, who would eventually flee to the Philippines, was found to have not only worked at Lockheed Aircraft, but in their elite Skunk Works division, well known in UFO research circles as the hub of exotic technology redevelopment. Ben Rich, the director of Skunk Works, known as the father of stealth, once said, "We now have the technology to take E.T. home." According to those who had attended his final lecture, he also said, "We had figured out how to do interstellar travel." He alluded to these technologies being wrapped up in black projects that would never be revealed. In a letter from July 1986, Rich explained that he believed in both man-made and extraterrestrial UFOs, explaining that many UFOs were just unfunded opportunities. As the head of Skunk Works, Rich was in a unique position to know. They were the very heart of UFO and X-technology development. How this 26-year-old security guard merited such a posh assignment at one of the world's most top-secret advanced development programs reflects the deep tentacles of CIA aerospace connections and their darkest secret, the lethal unit that protects the X technology inside the UFO file, X-Protect. James Earl Ray, the assassin of civil rights leader Martin Luther King in the official version of history, always maintained his innocence after his lawyer had him plead guilty to avoid the death penalty. Many of the key elements used to portray Ray as the lone gunman completely fell apart in subsequent investigations, like the House Select Committee on Assassinations and the 1999 civil trial of Lloyd Jowers. In the Jowers case, the jury found that government agencies had been involved in the King assassination. How did Ray come to be used as the patsy? His extensive travels to Canada, Mexico, and the UK show the fingerprints of intelligence work. Ray maintained that after he broke out of prison in 1967 for the robbery of a grocery store, that he went to Montreal and met a shadowy figure named Raoul, who assisted in getting him work, running guns, and paying him thousands of dollars. According to Ray, Raoul had asked him on the day of the King assassination to book a room at the New Rebel Motel that had a great view of the Lorraine Motel where King was staying. He then told him to purchase a rifle that Raoul could show to a new arms buyer. At the time of the shooting, three witnesses identified Ray over a mile away from the scene of the crime at a gas station. Ray's personal effects were intentionally left at the motel, along with the rifle that Raoul had asked Ray to buy. Raoul had been running Ray for nearly a year, gained his trust, and then the time had come to use him as the patsy for the MLK assassination. Years later, when pressed about Raoul in interviews, Ray still seemed reluctant to reveal too many details.
This is the man that you knew as Raoul?
Yes.
And you met him where?
Canada.
Up in Canada. Yeah. You just met in a saloon, or?
It was a saloon in a waterfront area of Montreal.
Mm-hmm. You never became good friends then?
No, I wasn't good friends. Mm-hmm. Just business then.
Ray would add sometimes that Raul also operated out of New Orleans, and they would often meet there for Raul to give him new assignments. The late DA of New Orleans, Judge Jim Garrison, who brought the only trial in the death of President John F. Kennedy against CIA businessman Clay Shaw, got an interesting lead on Raul, Jules Rico Campbell.
In the early part of our investigation into John Kennedy's murder, one of the most interesting individuals we encountered was Jules Rico Campbell. We learned from him about his relationship as spear carrier for the CIA here in New Orleans, his relationship with David Ferry and Clay Shaw, who were considerably more than spear carriers, who were involved here in New Orleans with the New Orleans and the murder of John Kennedy, and about Jules Rico Campbell's trip to Montreal, a town where he seemed to be knowledgeable, but we weren't able to get much more than that. But in the final sum of things, spear carrier or not, Jules Rico Campbell was a small load, but a rich one with a few specks of gold, and most useful in giving us insights into the role of the covert intelligence operation in the murder of John Kennedy.
Worked for the government, the CIA, for quite a few years. They paid an invasion to assassination of President Kennedy.
Kimball explains how his intelligence work led him to Montreal.
I had a contact there, and I would visit up there. At that time, CIA was working Quebec, free Canada, which was the French were trying to take over there. And I had done a couple jobs up there for them.
According to Kimball, the jobs he is referring to were two assassinations on behalf of the CIA.
See, CIA bailed back anybody as long as they can put a man on the inside.
During this 1989 interview with a British film crew, Kimball dropped a major bombshell. He was borrowed from the CIA by the FBI, and an agent took him to meet James Earl Ray at the Atlanta airport to fly him to Canada.
Yeah, Mr. Told me to take him up. They told me to pick up, go to Atlanta to Charlie Brown Airport, and this guy would meet me there. And I went there, and I stayed there, and he asked me, was my name Mr. Kimball? I said, yes. He said, well, you're passionate. I said, okay, well, you ready to go? Well, I took him to a place on Mount Royal Street, which is in Montreal itself, and I had a contact there. It was a CIA front in the building, and I got him up. His fake identification to
them. Kimball set Ray up with CIA contacts who gave him the identity of Eric S. Galt. Ray lived close by in Montreal to the real Eric S. Galt, a military contractor working in aerospace for Union Carbide with a high security clearance. Only a major intelligence official would have access to Galt's identity to supply it to Ray. In fact, it's now proven that Kimball was found to have been in Montreal when Ray was there. Kimball said he also flew Ray out of Montreal after the MLK assassination. According to Kimball's revelations, Ray was being moved around by covert agencies. And as we can see, Galt was clearly connected to secret aerospace activities. Garrison made the point that Kimball, in any case, had proven to be an excellent source.
Every single statement that he gave us turned out to be true without exception. There was no dissembling. There was the only, in retrospect, I can see from going through his whole file here, the only information that is not true is what had been planted in his mind back at that time towards the end of his service for the CIA here in the city, the covert operations. Is where they have planted in his mind the idea that he was really working for the Ku Klux Klan or the white citizens or something like that, which is kind of a standard operating procedure for intelligence agencies before they dismiss somebody after they've performed things. But in the final analysis, Kimball himself never lies.
When pressed if he was the elusive Raul in Ray's story, he agreed that he was and added,
They call me Rico.
So would you say that at least for the Canadian part of Ray's story, you were Raoul?
Oh, yes, I'm yes.
Ray had been carefully put into the position of being the patsy by covert intelligence operatives. Attorney William Pepper, who represented Ray at the Lloyd Jowers trial and wrote extensively on the case, learned from Ron Adkins, the son of mafia figure Russell Adkins Sr., that the warden of Missouri State Penitentiary was paid $25,000 to allow Ray to escape in 1967. According to Ron Adkins, the money had been delivered to his father by FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover's right-hand man and rumored lover, Clyde Tolson, who Ron knew as Uncle Clyde. This allowed Ray to be on the outside, to become a pawn of a clandestine assassination plan connected directly to an aerospace defense contractor. Before that, April 4th, 1968, rendezvous with Destiny, Ray had been led by Raoul to Beverly Hills. Here he would work extensively with a master hypnotist named Xavier Von Koss. He also had plastic surgery done on his nose. He started calling himself Eric Starvo Galt. Beverly Hills seemed like an odd place to be for a low-level criminal like Ray. Ray would meet with no less than 8 psychologists during his time in Los Angeles and actively consult with Scientologists. He was seen during this period obsessively reading Psycho-Cybernetics by Dr. Maxwell Maltz. The book was based on a cognitive behavioral technique by psychologist Prescott Lecky and the theories of physicist John von Neumann, an early proponent of quantum mechanics, who, according to physicist Robert Sarbarker, was in charge of the highly secretive UFO file. Ray was out of place in Beverly Hills, but the reasons for him being there became clear when it was later found that he'd made a series of calls to Litton Industries, a shadowy military contractor who had their headquarters right in the heart of Beverly Hills. The president of Litton Industries, Charles Tex Thornton, had spent a decade with Hughes Aerospace. He had taken the knowledge from his years with Hughes to develop some of the first ever space suits, eventually creating a major space division. The company would become one of the first conglomerates and would often land in the headlines in connection with corruption cases. They also reveled in the unusual location of Beverly Hills, not a traditional place for a military contractor. Their eccentricities extended to their headquarters, the old MCA Hollywood building, reimagined in even more posh style, with a treasure trove of Hollywood collectibles, like Shirley Temple's shoes, the stairway from Gone with the Wind, and extensive movie memorabilia from The Wizard of Oz. When Thornton headed up Litton Industries, he made a series of purchases for the company, including Ingalls Shipbuilding, who ran major shipyards in Pascagoula, Mississippi. Ray had claimed in a job application to have worked in this shipyard, giving the name of Litton Industries and stating he was a former employee. He also told the manager of a rooming house that he was on vacation from Ingalls Shipbuilding in Pascagoula. Ingalls Shipbuilding would be in the center of a worldwide controversy when a major UFO abduction case was reported by 2 employees of its F.B. Walker division in Pascagoula in October 1973, when Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker would claim they were abducted by robot-like beings into a large craft. The beings would paralyze them and perform examinations using very sophisticated technology. The craft was described as 40 feet wide with blinking blue lights. Calvin Parker describes what happened.
It landed behind us. We turned around, stood up, turned around and looked, and must have been a door that opened where all the bright lights come out of. They came out of the craft, and they come and picked us up then, and when they got us, they grabbed us by the shoulder right there. And that's when I felt the injection.
And 2 got a hold of me and 1 got a hold of Charlie and they took us inside. They did an examination. So when they examined us, we was probably in there, I'm gonna say 45 minutes. I'm not real sure. I didn't have a watch or nothing at the time. They put us back out at the same place we were, facing the water, and I was froze.
I was standing there facing the river with my arms stretched out like that. And I couldn't move them. I mean, I just took a minute just to get them freed up. And that's when I heard Charlie calling me in the back. He was down on the ground. I mean, he said he lost control of his legs. Then we turned around and faced the craft, which is sitting right about here. Then the lights just disappeared. The bright light disappeared. It picked straight up and went up a little ways, then it just disappears like lightning. I mean, it was gone.
The beings themselves are quite unusual, even for the alien abduction phenomena. Given the hundreds of cases on record, the possibility must be entertained that this was a genuine alien encounter with a UFO. The strangeness of the Litton Industries connection, however, casts a peculiar light on the entire incident. The spacesuits that Litton was making at the time closely resemble the kind of stiff, robotic description of these aliens. Later, the term military abductions, or MILABs, would come to be known as actions covert wings of military and intelligence would take to simulate an abduction scenario. A witness who saw the craft hovering would later describe a large splash taking place before the craft lifted off and left. After the splash, she looked down into the water and she saw one of the peculiar figures swim away from the scene under the water, just as the light was shooting up in the air. There's no question that Hickson and Parker were greatly disturbed by the incident. They were both highly credible and even passed lie detector tests to further substantiate their story. World-class UFO experts like J. Allen Hynek came forward to attest to the sincerity of their account. They maintained they were abducted and never changed their story for over four decades. But what really happened to them? And who was the wizard behind the curtain manipulating the strings? The presence of a notorious assassin in the same shipyard only a few years earlier raises the specter that Litton Industries was somehow testing out the X technology and using a standard abduction scenario as a cover for this highly secretive operation. A little-known report from the same Pascagoula shipyard area, just 3 weeks later, follows the activities of an officer trying to track peculiar lights seen under the water, further corroborating that some program was being tested at Pascagoula. It was noted by the Coast Guard that a large nuclear facility operated by Litton Industries for the U.S. Navy was close by to both incidents. Had the aliens returned? Was it Litton trying out X technology re-engineered from UFOs? Or all of the above? The Pascagoula UFO case is a web of strange connections, including the fact that Calvin Parker's father had previously worked at Area 51 for the Atomic Energy Commission. Did this make Parker a more attractive target for the abduction scenario, either by covert groups or an alien intelligence? Charles Hickson walked away from the experience with a profound sense of global awakening about off-world civilizations, and even reported continued experiences with the beings. Litton would thrive with their flagship company, Ingalls Shipbuilding, for many years, before Litton and its technology was sold to Northrop Grumman in 2001. Their years of black-budget aerospace defense contracts setting the stage for a massive space infrastructure, completely kept from the public behind a wall of secrecy, with the help of X-Protect. Back in 1963, a president saw the dangers that could arise from this unchecked power structure, and would give his life fighting it. Lee Harvey Oswald, the accused assassin of President John F. Kennedy, was portrayed by the FBI as a radical Marxist who hated America and got a lucky chance to shoot the president when JFK's motorcade went by the window of Oswald's new job at the Texas School Book Depository. The Warren Commission, a team of political insiders put together by President Johnson, who assumed the presidency when JFK was assassinated, was told their job was to shut down any questions about the involvement of the CIA or any possible conspiracies. Former CIA Director Alan Dulles, who had been fired by JFK, was brought in to oversee all intelligence connections to the case and suppress them. What was the government so worried about? After all, Oswald had been eliminated only 2 days after being accused of shooting JFK by Jack Ruby, a strip club owner linked to organized crime. During the brief time he was in custody, Oswald claimed he was innocent and was being set up as a patsy.
I don't know what this is all about. I work in that building.
Were you in the building at the time?
Naturally, if I work in that building, yes, sir.
Back up, man.
You're doing the president?
No, they're taking me in because of the fact that I'm innocent.
I'm just a patsy.
The problem for the Warren Commission was Oswald's involvement with the CIA and the highly secretive X-Protect wing that operated in the interest of intelligence and aerospace groups to protect the exotic X-technology in the UFO file. The first issue was, if Oswald were to be portrayed as a communist, they would need to explain his work during the summer before the assassination for the right-wing former head of the Chicago FBI office, Guy Bannister, in New Orleans. Bannister's office at 544 Camp Street was a focal point of anti-communist activity, and he was often referred to as to the right of Attila the Hun. How would a communist-leaning leftist who had lived in the Soviet Union find himself working with Bannister? When leaflets that Oswald had been handing out were discovered with Bannister's address on them, more witnesses came forward to say Oswald had worked for Bannister. A series of strange deaths followed these revelations, and these connections were kept out of official investigations. The New Orleans District Attorney, Jim Garrison, had come across these curious links when putting his case together against Clay Shaw in the JFK assassination. He knew Bannister from his FBI days and began to realize that Oswald had been set up.
Lee Harvey Oswald killed no one at all. So the point is, it wasn't a question of being alone or with anybody. He had nothing to do with the assassination.
Garrison believed that Bannister was the key to unraveling what was really behind the JFK assassination. Bannister's background in the FBI reveals the curious fact that he originated the X-Files, creating the name identification for UFO cases that he investigated for the Bureau. When Bannister died shortly before the Warren Commission was released in 1964, federal officials destroyed all of his files. However, a small set of file names were preserved by his wife, who eventually gave them to a local library. The file names give us an idea of what Bannister and his private detective agency front was really pursuing. One bombshell item of interest listed below the JFK assassination was Dinosaur Space Warcraft. This project, officially the Boeing X-20 Dinosaur, was originally conceived in Nazi Germany. One of the paperclip scientists brought over to create an X-series of space planes was Walter Dornberger, who was a general in the SS and Wernher von Braun's superior in the Nazi rocket program. Dornberger was originally slated to face death at Nuremberg for crimes against humanity by using inhumane methods on his slave labor population building the V-2 rockets. After his release and move to America, Dornberger had landed the post of vice president of Bell Helicopter in 1952. Dornberger's understudy at Bell was a promising engineer named Michael Payne, the son of the inventor of the Bell helicopter, Arthur Young. Payne and his wife, Ruth, hosted Lee Harvey Oswald and his Russian wife, Marina, at their home in Irving, Texas. Most of the incriminating evidence against Oswald, including the controversial backyard photo supposedly showing Oswald holding a rifle and a pistol, along with communist literature, which photo experts have repeatedly shown were tampered with, seemed to indicate the plan for making Oswald the patsy started very early. On November 23, 1963, the day after the assassination, Irving Police Captain Paul Barger reported that a telephone repairman had overheard a male voice, presumably Michael Payne, speaking from the Payne household in a telephone call, saying he did not feel Oswald was responsible, and he further stated, quote, "We both know who is responsible," unquote. Researchers later claimed the info had come from an FBI wiretap of Payne's phone, but he was never questioned about it. Dornberger was at the very core of the X-Technology program, and his greatest achievement, the X-15, still holds the record for a manned space plane set 60 years ago. The presence of Oswald at the home of Ruth and Michael Payne, with their deep connections to Dornberger, shows the tentacles of aerospace interests reaching into the major assassinations. Far from being the drifter and loser that the Warren Commission had portrayed him as, Oswald had actually been stationed at a high-security position in Atsugi in Japan during the development of the secret U-2 plane. In the summer before the JFK assassination, Oswald, while working at the Riley Coffee Company, which was a CIA front, was telling his fellow employees that he was going to work for NASA, which was why he was moving to Texas. When New Orleans DA Jim Garrison inquired about Oswald's fellow employees at Riley, he learned the odd fact that most of his co-workers had gone on to jobs at NASA or other aerospace companies. During the height of Garrison's investigation into Clay Shaw and the JFK assassination, he got in touch with Warren Hinkle, the publisher of Rampart's magazine, telling him it was urgent that they speak immediately. Hinkle's account follows. "This is urgent," Jim Garrison said. Can you take this in the mailroom? They'd never think to tap the mailroom extension. Garrison began talking when I picked up the mailroom extension. This is risky, but I have little choice. It is imperative that I get this information to you now. Important new evidence has surfaced. Those Texas oil men do not appear to be involved in President Kennedy's murder in the way we first thought. It was the military-industrial complex that put up the money for the assassination. But as far as we can tell, the conspiracy was limited to the aerospace wing. I've got the names of three companies and their employees who were involved in setting up the president's murder. Do you have a pencil? I wrote down the names of the three defense contractors. Garrison identified them as being Lockheed, Boeing, and General Dynamics, and the names of those executives in their employ, whom the district attorney said had been instrumental in the murder of Jack Kennedy. I said that I had everything down, and Garrison said a hurried goodbye. It's poor security procedure to use the phone, but the situation warrants the risk. I wanted you to have this in case something happens. The investigation trail led Garrison directly to the aerospace companies developing the X technology in the UFO file. His arrest of Clay Shaw was a shot across the bow. It would eventually be revealed that Shaw had been a CIA asset and had a murky trail of associates, including David Ferry, a CIA pilot who had worked closely with Guy Bannister. Ferry was also an expert hypnotist. Garrison discovered that Ferry had been Oswald's squad commander in the Civil Air Patrol when Oswald was only 15. The grooming of Oswald by Ferry and intelligence services had paid off when he was selected as the patsy for the JFK assassination. Garrison was planning to bring Ferry to trial for conspiracy. Instead, Ferry died mysteriously and left behind typed suicide notes. Garrison's case against Clay Shaw collapsed. The CIA had worked overtime behind the scenes to undermine it, according to Victor Marchetti, an assistant to CIA Director Richard Helms. The media would also be used to demonize Garrison's efforts at revealing the truth. When Garrison's Shaw trial was over in 1969, a mysterious document appeared, leaked by an unknown insider who called himself William Torbett. The document revealed a previously unknown government division called Defense Industrial Security Command, or DISC, which was described as a NASA security division, headed by former Nazi rocket scientist Wernher von Braun. The Torbett document identified the following individuals as DISC agents: Guy Bannister, Clay Shaw, David Ferry, Lee Harvey Oswald, and Lewis Mortimer Bloomfield. Bloomfield had headed up Permandex, a CIA front world trade company that specialized in assassinations and was based in Montreal. The earliest blueprint for a group linked directly to X-Protect had been revealed in the mysterious Torbett document. President Kennedy's desire to open the UFO file and share it with the Russian government for purposes of a joint moon mission, as demonstrated in National Security Action Memorandum 271 and his November 12th memo to the director of the CIA. Kennedy had struggled his entire presidency with the out-of-control intelligence community to reassert presidential power over their unconstitutional actions. He mused to aides in private that he was going to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the wind. A major piece of this effort was reasserting control over the UFO file that had been lost at the end of the Eisenhower administration. E. Howard Hunt, the CIA super spy, best known as the coordinator of the Watergate burglars, revealed to his close friend and attorney for the Watergate 7, Douglas Caddy, the nature of the desperate struggle between JFK and the CIA over the UFO file. Caddy revealed to me what Hunt told him in this interview.
And then we walked out, and on the street there, I thought, well, this is the last time I see Howard. I'm going to make one more stab, okay, at seeing if I can get something here, you know. And I said, well, Howard, why was John Kennedy assassinated? He said, why was John Kennedy assassinated? He said, John Kennedy was assassinated because he was about to give our most vital secret to the Soviets. About to give our most vital secret to the Soviets. And I was stunned by that. I mean, John Kennedy, our president, Soviets, and I never even heard about such a thing. And I said, well, what was that? And at that point, he leaned forward and looked right in my eyes, directed my eyes, and he said, the alien presence. And he reached out and shook my hand and then turned and walked away. And that was the last time I saw Howard Hunt. It didn't mean that much to me. I knew it was important, but it did not mean that much. There's no way I could, in alien presence, I was not really familiar with that either, you know. But I remembered it. I knew it was important.
This breakthrough revelation from a top CIA officer to his friend in private gives us the real mandate of X-Protect. Any official, even the president, who wants to reveal the true nature of the X-technology in the UFO file must be eliminated. They've used this protocol for decades, but their attempts to conceal their actions have at times taken an unexpected turn. George Joannetis had been a pivotal figure in CIA psychological warfare operations during his long career. His work was so secret that it's an accident of history that we even know his name. Journalist Jefferson Morley uncovered it when looking at an intelligence front group called the DRE back in the Kennedy era when Joannetis created the Oswald Project, the ultimate psychological warfare operation. When the House Select Committee on Assassinations convened in the late 70s, the CIA, at risk of exposure, turned to their best psychological warfare officer, Joannetis, to keep their role in the assassination hidden. For his efforts, Joannetis was awarded the Career Achievement Medal. His records have never been released. The CIA has spent millions in legal fees concealing his past. The man who gave Joannetis his medal may give us a clue to the role he played in relation to X-Protect. Bobby Ray Inman, then the deputy CIA director, had a career that was just as mysterious as Joannetis was. He was one of the few government officials who discussed UFOs openly. He went on record saying that recovered vehicles or alien craft were in the possession of the government. He even claimed to have some expertise in the area of UFOs after he retired. He said he was aware of a program to indoctrinate the public about UFOs and was quoted as saying the following. That he, quote, understood who was behind the technology in the crafts, unquote. These are major statements by someone who served in such positions as NSA director and deputy director of the CIA. Inman would eventually wind up on the board of XE, a mercenary outfit used in covert warfare. When we look at Joannetis and Inman, we can see the impact of X-Protect on our policies that lead us right up to the present with battles over the UFO file continuing and spilling over into private enterprise. The X-steganography of SpaceX and Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin show that these groups are ready to unleash what has been in development since Hughes Aerospace started down the road of immense secrecy. The Trump administration creation of the Space Force as the sixth branch of the armed services is also an attempt to pull the X-technology back under presidential control. X-Protect has thrived in secrecy and have utilized the X-technology in the UFO file at the public's expense for decades. The world at large has not had access to the UFO information that's been withheld by a vast power structure sitting in the strange partnership between the CIA on one side and the aerospace defense contractors on the other. It is in fact a covert government that has usurped the public overt government and put in place the perfect storm of a global control grid that's being built with no oversight, but lots of unlimited dollars thanks to the missing trillions at the Pentagon, HUD, and NASA. X-Protect has been there every step of the way, and now we hear from the same partnership between the CIA and the aerospace defense companies that UFOs are a threat and must be added to an already bloated defense budget. And the New York Times runs stories with CIA officials claiming they will give the public UFO disclosure. That soft disclosure means that X-Protect is in a position to roll out the X-technology, which means the world is a more dangerous place than ever before. As we remember those who have fallen while fighting X-Protect, we must remember we can move our culture forward by destroying the wall of secrecy erected by these covert organizations. The only way we can do it is to expose X-Protect and the lethal means that they've used to control every aspect of society. In the final analysis, if we are to understand the power structure on planet Earth, we must understand X-Protect and hold them accountable for their actions. The whole world is watching and waiting. I'm Dark Journalist. Thank you for joining me, and I look forward to seeing you soon.